My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and I am here with good friend Amy from the podcast. It is St. Patrick's Day, and we are not wearing green, and we are not drinking beer.
We are not.
We are recording a podcast. So
that just goes to show you how evil it becomes when you leave the church.
That's right.
We sit around and on the floor and drink bottled water.
That's right. Okay, so many of you probably know Amy from Mormon Expression. She's been on several episodes. Off the top of your head, what are the episodes you've been on?
Top 10 Mormon bad guys. Did the top 10 places to see when you're in Salt Lake. Did some Article of Faith ones.
Weren't you on 8 and 9?
8 and 9. Yeah, 8, 9. 7, 8, 9?
8 and 9.
8 and 9. Yeah, we only did two.
Yeah. Not the Articles of Faith, the D&C 8 and 9.
Oh, yeah, that was kind of my bull in a china shop moment where I just kind of grabbed the microphone and was like, comment from the peanut gallery.
Was that?
Yeah, it was to Mike.
That was that the night that we figured out that we're next door neighbors?
Yes.
That was the night?
Yes, Heather and I are next door neighbors, y'all.
I could have sworn you were sitting right next to me, though.
We were sitting next to each other.
You just weren't supposed to be on the panel that
night? Right, no, I was not.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, so I guess we're going to talk about your journey through Mormonism, which is a little like mine in that you didn't get married to a good Mormon and go through the temple and pop out a bunch of Mormon kids and then, well, find out it's not true, right?
Right.
Okay. So why don't we start at the beginning?
Let's go back a minute.
And, well, we can go back even further than the beginning here on Earth because you were obviously in the correct host of heaven.
Yes, I was. B.I.C., bitches, born in the covenant.
So tell me about your family and what it was like to be a Mormon as a kid.
My mother was a Catholic convert. She married my biological father. They met at BYU summer school in 1972. Quickly fell in love, got married, had me like 9 months and 2 weeks later. Yeah, thank God for the 2 weeks. And quickly got a divorce, had another child, my brother. And then he was excommunicated for adultery. I think no one has ever yet been completely honest with me about it. If you ask my mom, he committed adultery. If you ask my dad, it was a whole host of other things that had nothing to do with,
like, apostasy?
Errant penis placement.
So, like, he was dabbling in anti-Mormonism?
No. No. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it's obvious.
No idea.
Yeah. He doesn't want to cop to it.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to cop to it.
Did he ever come back?
Or? He did come back. He actually, as an excommunicated member, proselytized to my stepmother, and she got baptized.
While he was still exed.
I believe so. Yeah, because he recently got rebaptized like maybe 6 years ago. So he went back to church as an excommunicated member for off and on for 30 years.
Oh, okay.
And then, and was kind of a, definitely, he was a Sunstone Mormon. Back then they didn't have labels, nom, all that, that didn't really exist. He hung around with liberal minded folks and, he really is identified greatly with the cultural Mormon aspects of it. My family goes back pioneer days, Willie Hancart Company Jens Nielsen is my great, great, great grandfather. And so he really identified, he likes to identify with that portion of his Mormonism, but his lifestyle and his personal ethics don't really go with the straight and narrow. So he's just kind of carved out his own identity within the Mormon church. So he didn't raise me, needless to say. My mother married my stepfather, who was a born again fundamentalist Christian Baptist boy, which did not go over well. We were the
outcast. With the family.
Yeah, we were the outcast. We were the divorced Mormons' kids. You know, we were all kinds of wrong in that family. And then my mom tried to do that whole Baptist thing for a couple years. She still wore her garments though. And finally had it and told my stepdad, I can't do this anymore. You've got to at least take the discussions and find out for yourself if the church is true, because I can't raise my kids Baptist anymore.
Even, do you know what she was opposed to?
As far as the Baptist goes?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't true.
It wasn't Mormon.
It wasn't the true church. She's hardcore faithful. And she was, I think, being a young divorced woman in the early, late 70s, I think that when she married my stepdad, she was really just trying to do the best she could as far as trying to keep her family intact and moving forward. And so I think at the time she reconciled, well, he's a spiritual man and he loves God and he's a good man. He's a police officer. I can't really do, I mean, I could do much worse for myself. So I'm going to see if I can just, you know, have a multi-faith family. Mm-hmm. But as many of us know, evangelical Christians are not really friends of the Mormons.
Right.
And so I think she had a really hard time trying to make that work for herself, because she never doubted that the church was true. And so it just finally got to a point where it was like, listen, if we're going to do this and have children and everything, you've got to at least know for yourself. And I think my mom was probably even willing to walk away from the marriage if he did not convert. And he ended up converting. And it was really strange because he converted. I knew that we were Mormon, but my earlier childhood recollections did not include a lot of memories in the church, because at age like 5, 6, 7, 8, she was newly married and we were going to the Baptist church. So it was kind of like all of a sudden we were just going to a new church. I didn't understand the differences between denominations. It was just the Baptist church was a lot more fun and the Mormon church smelled funny. And so my stepdad started taking the discussions, and I think like maybe the third discussion in, he like had one of these monumentous rapid fire conversions. And it was like on Wednesday we were going to the Baptist church, and on Saturday he was getting baptized.
But so he was coming from an evangelical Baptist church that was heavy on the Mormons or a cult and all of that.
Yeah, showing Godmaker video weekend viewings and things.
And he joined in spite of, so he really believed it was true then.
Hardcore. Like he had, I mean, it was like the angel Moroni came down to him himself and laid hands upon him and gave him a testimony.
I'm assuming you're saying that figuratively. Like, or was that how he explained his experience?
That's not how he explained it, but I can only imagine, knowing my dad the way that I do, that it was a very powerful experience.
Okay. And you've never asked him about what it was?
We've talked a lot about it, and he would just describe it in simple terms. I knew it was revealed to me. I instantly had a testimony. Okay. I knew it. I had the feeling. He did the prayer, you know.
Moroni 10:4-5 worked.
Apparently. Swiftly, okay. It worked. And I was 8 at the time, because I got baptized over New Year's weekend. New Year's weekend. So I was a few months older, like 8 years old and a few months. And he got baptized and was confirmed that day so that he could baptize me the next day.
Oh, wow.
So it was like a full family conversion all of a sudden. He, and I don't know, I can't remember what the normal turn of events would normally be with something like that, but he was confirmed and had the, what is it, the Aaron? Melchizedek mm-hmm. was given the Melchizedek.
He's made an elder.
Yeah. Because he was baptized on a Saturday and I was baptized on a Sunday. So he got all of this stuff done so that he could baptize me the next day and confirm me the next day. And it was just like, boom, we're all back in the church.
Wow. So I'm assuming that made your mother very happy. How did that affect your family life or your life? Did you all of a sudden become really Mormon?
And never looked back.
So what was that like when you were 8? Going to church all the time, family home evening, all of that?
All of that stuff. I knew that it was a big deal just because I was so scared of it. There was so much legalism is the best way I can describe it. Just there were so many rules and regulations and so many expected to do this, expected to do that. We are LDS. We do this. We do that. That it really scared me a lot. Like I wasn't used to that. The day that I got baptized, and if I'm remembering correctly, the first Sunday that new year was also a fast and testimony Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already scared out of my mind to get baptized because in the Baptist church, they don't baptize kids. You have like a personal conversion and adults get baptized and it's like a, you know, it's a big deal that way. They don't baptize children. So I had never seen anything like this happen before, and I was terrified. I was truly terrified. I was sick to my stomach. I begged my mom to please let me eat, but it was all. But now it's Fast and Testimony Sunday, and we're Mormon, and you're fasting. And I had no idea what that was supposed to mean. All I know is that I was freaking starving. I was scared out of my mind. I didn't know what I was doing, as far as like I'm joining this church now, and. My mom, I believe she let me eat a BLT. Like, I'm going way back here. And I got sick to my stomach and I threw up. And
before church or after church?
Before church. Church.
Okay.
And I remember her saying something to the effect of that the adversary works really hard on those that are about to be baptized. And that this was an example of that, that me being sick, me being scared, me, you know, getting sick to my stomach and eating. This was all the devil trying to work his witchcraft magic on me to try and, I don't know, keep me out of the church, which again, terrified me. These were all concepts that I had no ability to comprehend or wrap my mind around. I was just thinking, what in the hell are my parents about to make me do? Why are we doing this? I didn't feel like I didn't have the coping skills.
So it was kind of like by saying that the devil is real and is working on you, it's almost like saying the boogeyman is real and he's in your closet. And if you get out of bed, he's going to get you type of.
Oh, yeah. It was very real.
Okay.
It was very real. And because of the feelings I was having, the fact that I got sick and they were all coinciding with this major event that was taking place, to me, it was all proof.
Right. That it was real. Okay. That's not a very, like I said before we started recording, that's not a very Mormon devil. I mean, yeah, technically the Mormon church believes in like a hands-on devil, but I think you'd be hard pressed to find a TBM who would, well, maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
Because I guess they would say that the devil is working on you, but not like in a direct, like I'm behind your back, you know, making your stomach pee, you know.
I believed those kind of things.
Yeah.
When I heard things in the night, I literally believed that there were demons outside my house. Mm-hmm. You know, that the sleeping comas that people have, you know, and then they think they've been abducted by aliens and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
I had those kinds of experiences growing up, and I was 110% absolutely positive that it was Satan in my room, that I had beings descending upon me, holding me down, you know, preventing me from breathing, that kind of thing. Like, I believe that...
That sleep paralysis stuff.
Yeah. And I believed that that was Satan.
Okay. And that was when you were 8. So you got baptized. Did that make you feel better or made you feel worse?
It didn't make me feel one way or the other. It just made me feel
like I'm in it now.
I'm in it now. Here we go. Here we go. This is what we are. This is, we are Mormons. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we started going to church, where we were living, my parents were planning on moving. And so we started going to a new chapel or a new ward, mm-hmm. Prior to us actually moving out of our home so that we would have, you know, familiar relationships and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it'd be like moving from West Valley to, you know, Holiday or Bountiful. We didn't live in like a poor area before, but it was more of an urban environment, more blue collar type workers. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to a much more financially affluent area. And I immediately felt this huge divide between who the good power Mormons were all the ones that had tons of money. And then here we were, not quite in that status. We were technically new converts, even though, you know, I was born a Mormon. I just hadn't been raised in it for the first 8 years of my life, really. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I always felt really inadequate.
Around the other people in your stake?
Around the other kids.
Okay.
Like, I could tell that they knew their stuff and that I had all the good things that Mormon kids are supposed to know about themselves and feel about themselves. And I didn't get that. Like, I couldn't figure it out. And they just all seemed so much better than I was.
So by power stake, correct me if I'm wrong, but you come from, or power Mormons, I mean, you come from an area where a lot of well-known Mormons are from.
Right. There, people that speak in general conference were in my stake. I went to mm-hmm. high school with
their kids
that are general authorities, mm-hmm. big power players, sports people up at BYU were in okay. I went to high school with. Okay. So
this is like the cream of the Mormon crop?
Pretty much. Kind of like the Mormons glitterati, so to speak, you know?
Okay. So it would be like somebody in Utah growing up in Bountiful around general authorities and their children.
Exactly the same.
Okay. And you, even though you kind of had the same pedigree they had as far as like pioneer stock and all of that, you didn't ever feel like you matched up to them?
No, because it was just such a different world that Mormon idea. I never identified with that part of my Mormon heritage because it was my biological father's Mormon heritage. And I've got a ex-Catholic convert Mormon mom and an ex-Baptist stepfather who are now raising me. So even though all those things are true, you know, very right, you know, I'm a daughter of a Utah pioneer, mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to kind of claim that heritage because with the divorce from my mom and dad also came a lot of baggage in that those kind of things I didn't get to claim any benefit from that relationship because my mom just did not want to.
You had to like show your loyalty to the other
side. Absolutely. Yeah. And there were lots of, you know, she would constantly, if something bad was happening, she'd say, oh, well, that's your father's genes. That's happening because this, yeah. Or you're really showing your such and such, my maiden name, colors when you do things like that, because that's something your father would do. So it was not a bonus that I had pioneer heritage. Okay. In fact, it was almost like, you know, you should be better than that if you think you're going to claim that.
Okay. So then did that cultivate for you like you were already not very happy about being Mormon and it didn't really work for you? Maybe we should talk about that first.
Okay.
So you didn't, you weren't happy about getting baptized. The church was terrifying to you. As you became a, And the devil was like a real presence in your home, right? That anytime there was anything going on with you or one of your siblings or anything like that, it was the devil is influencing you type of stuff.
Right. My brother had a very hard time adjusting to the relationship with my stepfather. And so coming from the fact that he was in law enforcement, he had a very black and white way of raising us. And there was a lot of physical punishments in our house. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, I guess, interrogation. Like, you know, it was like Guantanamo in a way. You know, up late at night, singled out, sitting in the dark, being yelled at, being reprimanded, being humiliated. And I was not hit as much as my brother was, but when he was disciplined, it was serious. And there was a lot of screaming and a lot of crying. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were people, like neighbors, that had my dad not been a police officer, they would have called the police, because it was very chaotic. And those kinds of things were blamed on the adversary, that our behavior was letting the adversary in. I wasn't ever really clear on, when I look back on it, none of the behavior that was going on in our house was anything abnormal. It was normal kid stuff. That was the way that they dealt with it, though. That was their solution and their explanation to it. He almost went to Utah Boys Home a few times. Had my family been able to afford it, or had the bishop maybe felt
compelled to pay for it.
Yeah, he would have ended up there, and I'm so glad he didn't, knowing what we know now about that place. But that was also the time when, like, the teen ranches and the desert treks and all that kind of stuff was getting really popular. And I was so afraid that my brother was going to end up in one of those, and I'd never see him again.
And all because of the devil.
All because of the devil, and it was so powerful that, you know, cunning and baffling. It's like, how do you control something you can't see? How do you defend yourself against something that you don't understand? Why is this happening? Why don't I get it? You know, something's obviously really intrinsically wrong with me if I'm not finding peace in my membership in the church, if I'm not feeling like this specialness, almost like a tragic uniqueness, so to speak. Why am I not able to really pull my faith together and just find some peace and solace and, you know, the eternities and everything else like that? Like something, like I just couldn't figure out why I wasn't getting it and why I was being continually attacked by the adversary.
Okay. So you were in Young Women's and being told all these lessons about how wonderful it is to be a Mormon and how happy your life is supposed to be. Yeah. And did you like pray to find out if the church was true?
I just assumed it was. Even though it made me miserable, I assumed that it was true. I had no reason to believe that it wasn't. It never occurred to me that it wouldn't be true or couldn't be true or wasn't anything that it was taught to me to be. I did my Young Women in Excellence. I did all of my seminary stuff. I worked in the bishop's storehouse on the weekends with my family whenever we got, you know, assigned to do those kind of things. We did every kind of social church event that could be done. My closest friends were in the church. Like, I was in the Young Women's Presidency. I spoke in sacrament meeting. I did all of the things I was supposed to do. In a way, I guess it never even occurred to me that I would need to pray to find out if it was true, because I was born into it and I was already baptized. And even now thinking about it, I would almost think like, well, that's for converts.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. People who are born into the church don't really need to find out if it's true or not, because they've already been given the blessing of being in it.
Okay, so if you're praying to believe it's true, it's because you're having like a crisis of faith and and you just knew it was true because that was your environment.
It didn't occur to me that it was a crisis of faith. I just figured it was a crisis of self. Like, there was something just wrong with me, and I didn't feel like prayer could fix that.
Okay.
It was way beyond that.
Okay. there was something fundamentally wrong with your character.
Yeah.
That's what you felt like.
Absolutely. Okay. Something, and I attributed it maybe like, well, I guess my dad is to blame for this. Like the bile, you know, all these, my maiden name is Rap. And so it was those damn Rap genes my mom keeps talking about. This is why my dad was excommunicated. He couldn't accept the truthfulness. He couldn't abide by the standards and guidelines and principles of the church. I have inherited this flaw that is keeping me from feeling the spirit of God.
Okay. Were there any church doctrines that you liked, or conversely, any church doctrines that really bothered you?
The first, polygamy never bothered me. And even today, I'm one of those probably rare women that, religiously motivated or not, could probably be very happy in a polygamous marriage. I don't really have a problem with that. I have a problem, and I've talked to my mom about this many times, because she's one of those women that tries to commit sin regularly so she doesn't wind up in the celestial kingdom and have to deal with it.
Sad.
I know. And it blew my mind when she admitted that to me. I just thought, wow, Mom, did you hear what you just said? Really, did you hear what you just said? But the first time I realized that, like really truly understood that the Mormon Church had prevented blacks from having the priesthood, I was, I don't know, probably 12, 13, 14. It kind of stopped me in my tracks because my initial response was, wait a minute. I know my articles of faith. And I know that as Mormons, we believe in a much higher law, which is we are responsible for our own actions and our own sins and not for Adam's transgression. Back the truck up. Right. What just happened? Because right. That makes no sense to me. And it was devastating. It just, I almost was thinking, this can't possibly be God's one true church if this is how the one true God operates. What am I missing? That is so wrong on so many levels. And of course, I always had crushes on black men, so let's get real, Heather. Just another example of my fundamental flaws. Mm-hmm. I was chasing after the seed of Cain, and that just wasn't going to work.
So did you ask anybody about that, or like voice your objections?
When those things would come up, and it's kind of funny, these kind of conversations would kind of just trickle out naturally as like, say we were ironing clothes for Sunday, or, you know, we had finished
Saturday's
church.
Saturday's a special day.
Right. Saturday is a special day. Well, look at today is Saturday, Heather. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's special. But, you know, like getting ready for a fireside, just very casual conversations, not anything that I would consider indoctrination. But when I would hear these things, I would literally say, Mom, how could that be true? Or why would that happen? But I was treated as though I was being kind of an impetulant, rebellious teenager for asking such questions. Like whenever I was told that the Garden of Eden was in Jackson County, Missouri, I was just like, what? Come on, really? And I was kind of treated as though, like, you're just acting like that because you're just being a smart ass. Like, didn't take any of it really seriously. And then it was kind of just laid back on my plate. Like, obviously you have a problem with your faith, because this would not seem strange to you if all your ducks were in a row and you had
a testimony,
which I was honestly, at this point, I was so afraid of everything that just, it was in my mind, there were so many checks and balances and so many little compartments of where certain people went in heaven and where certain people waited and where some families went and where some families didn't go and where, you know, excommunicated members or non-members for that matter, just this big corporation of the haves and the have-nots, basically. I didn't want the church to be true. I believed that it was because I had no reason to believe that it wasn't. But I was just so tormented with the fact that I really believed that it was true, because it was a terrifying prospect that this is what heaven and the gospel and what God is like, because it seemed cruel to me. So much of it just seemed really cruel and not an inclusive. I guess deep down inside, I've always been with like a bedwetting liberal. Like, I just didn't get this sense of elite. We are the best. We are the chosen. I mean, I was raised with the idea that because I was white and blonde haired with blue eyes, born in the United States, born into a Mormon family, in a strong ward with, you know, valiant leaders, that I was the chosen one and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, that's nice to hear, but it also hurts to hear, because I didn't do anything to earn any of that. Or so I believed. I just happened to be born that way. And what does that say about people that are not born that way?
So you actually took the time to think about those things.
Yeah. It bothered me. It bothered me that was being taught in God's church, and that I was supposed to believe that. I was supposed to latch onto that, and it was supposed to make me feel good. But it just made me feel worse. It made me feel bad about what I was supposed to become. Not a good feeling. Not a good feeling at all. I didn't like it.
Okay. And I imagine that coming from a divorced family, that like eternal families was a problem for you.
Oh, I remember laying in bed crying and singing myself to sleep with the families can be together forever through Heavenly Father's plan. And once again, it just didn't make sense. Like, kind of like, how could a loving God do this kind of a thing? I didn't understand how this all worked together. I didn't understand how it was supposed to all fit. And I felt a sense of, I felt the tearing of wanting to have a sense of loyalty to my father, my biological father, mm-hmm. who, you know, was excommunicated and everything else. But yet I have to be with this family, my Mormon family, because I'm doing everything right that puts me in this category. So how do I have, what happens to my other family? And why do I feel this enormous sense of guilt and shame as a kid? Like, why am I being burdened with this if it's all supposed to work out in the end anyway? Like, I just...
Did you ever ask questions about that?
No, because I didn't want my mom to know I was even thinking about it.
Because you'd already experienced that you're just being a smart ass.
She wanted so little to do with my father, my biological father, mm-hmm. that the showing any kind of love or loyalty towards him was a very uncomfortable thing to experience. And I didn't want my mom to have to even imagine a heaven where my biological father would have anything to do with us.
And you said you were born in the covenant, so they had been married in the temple.
Yes.
And I am assuming they hadn't received a temple divorce.
My mom did not receive a temple divorce until my mom and stepdad had been married for a few years. They were civilly married in the Baptist church. And I think she had to wait. I know Spencer W. Kimball is the one that, quote unquote, signed her temple divorce. And I think it was early 80s. So she had been married to my biological father, sealed still in the temple, I guess. And that has always been a confusion for me as well. Like, how, if he's bad enough to be excommunicated, why are they making you stay married to him?
Right.
How's that work out?
You'd think it would be automatically canceled.
You would think. But apparently, the blessings of the priesthood are much more powerful. even with an unworthy man attached to an unworthy man. But she finally got a temple divorce. I would say probably like 1983, 84, 85.
So by the time you were having these questions, though, she was no longer sealed to him.
No. And
but
no.
There was still the my kids are sealed to him, so that's what she doesn't want to. I can see why you wouldn't want to bring it up with her, I guess.
No, and she had moved on with her new worthy priesthood holder and was having children with him. And my two sisters were eventually... I had one sister who was born before they got sealed. So she had to go in and get sealed with them when they got married, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
So it was just... It would kind of be just like, it's bad manners. It was like bad manners to bring up my dad.
Okay. Okay. So your teenager, as a teenager, it was rather rough.
It was.
Because of the church.
It was. It was tough because of the church and everything that all this, for lack of a better term, all the standards I was supposed to be living up to. I never felt like I was going to measure up to any of it. I didn't relate to the desires of wanting to get married in the temple. I figured I would. I figured, although the thought of going through the temple terrified me. The fact that my mom couldn't tell me about it terrified me. But then she'd let weird little things trickle out every once in a while. Like I heard about the death oaths. You know, something to the effect of, oh, when you go through the temple, you'll understand then because you make very serious covenants, to the Lord that you would, you know, something to the effect of that you would rather die than reveal the
right
ordinances or whatever she said. And I was terrified. Like what do they do in there?
Right.
And just for me, I got the types of lessons in Young Women's about the, you know, the licked cupcake lessons and the rose that's crumpled and no one wants the crumpled flower. And I got all of those. And I knew I was a sexual person. I knew that I had sexual feelings. I was really curious about it. I had all of the raging hormones that every teenage boy has. And it was such a conflict. Like I didn't know how to reconcile everything that was going on inside of me to what I assumed everyone else had in check.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that all the other sweet sisters in my classes, like I was the demon, like I was the one being tempted by, you know, sexual desires and sexual fantasies and all of those kinds of things. Because I felt way different. I felt really different apart from those girls.
As you had the whole time you'd lived there, right?
Yeah. I never felt a part of like that pure, tender, sweet sister type stuff. Like that just never felt like who I was.
You always felt like the black sheep.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely. Even though at that point I had never done anything to... you know, bring this darkness upon myself.
But who you inherently are, though, like anybody that knows you knows that you're kind of one of those like free spirit, badass, really strong personality with your own really strong tastes, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're just naturally being that way. You're not going to fit into the conformed.
Right. And I've tried to explain that to my mom as, you know, I've grown up and is that, you know, mom, I didn't tried to feel this way. I didn't want to decide. I didn't want to leave the church. I didn't want to question it. That was just my natural nature. My natural way of thinking led me down this path. I didn't wake up one day and go, you know what? I think I'm going to decide the church is not true. I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to throw a wrench in the works and I'm just going to for sport just muck everything up and ruin my eternal family and make my parents' lives miserable. It was just a natural way of thinking and questioning. And, you know, 1 + 1 didn't equal 2. And I kind of looked at that and went, wait a minute, everyone. That doesn't make any sense. Or this, I feel like I'm a normal person, but I'm being taught that my normal ways of thinking and feeling are wrong.
Or the natural man, and you needed to put them off.
Right, right. It just, it never made any sense. And all the while, I must add, all these high and mighty general authority sons were all up on this. And so I was baffled by how they could get away with it. They seemed to be able to get away with it just fine. They still passed the sacrament. They still blessed the sacrament. They were still the power players. You know, they were still the Eagle Scouts. They were still, oh, so respected. And so, but they were obviously doing the same things I was. I mean, at that point, at like 16 years old, and I'm not even talking about sex. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first experience of like that double standard when it comes to women in the church and men in the church and how we're treated. Mm-hmm, I always felt really gypped that I didn't get to bless this, or not bless the sacrament, pass the sacrament. Like, for real, the 12-year-old boys get to do it, but I can't do it. Like, why can't I do it? Why don't I get to do fun stuff like
what's
that?
What's so sacred about passing a tray around? Or
yeah, and it's white bread, really?
Okay, but you were also like surveilled, right? Like, didn't you tell me that your parents would like read your journal and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's when things started getting really bad.
And that was when you were an older teenager?
I was probably... The first time they read my diary, I was probably 14 or 15.
Okay.
And that was the last time I ever wrote in my diary, or had a journal for that matter, until after I moved away from home. And we can talk about why I had to move out. We weren't allowed to lock the bathroom door. We had no sense of privacy. Everything was kind of fair game in my house. And so,
because if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to hide.
Right.
Type of a thing.
Right. And I should be an open book to a priesthood holder. Like, I should just surrender myself to the gospel, basically. Mm-hmm. And part of our like at home personal progress, I guess you could say, was that we had to, aside from all the other scripture study that we would do in the morning prayer, evening prayer, all that kind of stuff, and then seminary stuff, and then church stuff, and then whatever fireside or youth activity we were doing, like we had personal stuff that we were assigned to do, and then we had, part of that was journal writing, is that we had to write in our journals every week. And of course, it was because the prophet Joseph wrote in his journal all the time, and all the good, you know, leaders of the church have always documented their spiritual journeys, and that's what we should do. And so I was forced to write things, and then they would go through them and read them. And the first time that happened, there was actually what I would consider like a full-on domestic violence situation.
Because I didn't like what you wrote?
Because I was terrified to... I didn't really remember what I had written. I mean, there really wasn't anything in there. But the fact that I had no privacy, like I just... there was like a 51-50 split happened in my brain. Like I went temporarily crazy pants, and I was running around the house, holding on to my diary, trying to like hide, and you know, just like they do in the horror movies, you know, like, you know, you're falling over nothing, and you're running into rooms with no doors or windows that you can never escape from, and it was just sheer panic. And I ended up running into my parents' bathroom of all places, and my dad, he's very big, very large, tall, strong. Picked me up with one hand, ripped my diary out from under me with the other hand, and just threw me down in the shower like a rag doll. And I had a bruise on the back of my calf, and I had a big lump on the back of my head, and my mom is screaming and crying, and he's basically invoking his priesthood rights to you know, monitor my spiritual growth. And they sat me down on their bed and they just taunted me. They just looked at me and just kind of thumbed through the pages and just, you know, if there's something that's in here that you don't want us to read, you can either tell us now or we're taking this to the bishop and he can decide. And it's not a surprising fact that I became a cutter. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Very unhealthy.
Yeah.
So obviously there was a lot of unhealthiness in your teenage years. And it seems like it was all brought on by the church.
It was definitely motivated by the church because my dad was a very well-respected priesthood holder and mm-hmm. still is. And I've mended my relationship with him quite a bit. There's some things that went on in the house that I look back on now that if they ever happened to my daughter, there would be some, as a mother of a teenage girl, mm-hmm. I have a really hard time understanding how my mother let some of those things happen. Mm-hmm. And I know that just based on the conversations she and I had, just like I said earlier, you know, ironing your clothes on Sunday, just those mother-daughter conversations, she really took the temple oath of obeying her husband very seriously. And she did not believe, I believe, and still believe to this day, that she does not believe that anything was fundamentally wrong, that he did not do anything fundamentally wrong because he was honoring his priesthood covenants, and that he was an honored priesthood holder. He was in the bishopric. He was, you know, elders quorum president. And he would not have had those opportunities had he been a bad man. So the fact that he was choosing to discipline us these ways, that he was choosing to interfere with my own ability to think, I started to believe that he could read my thoughts. I started to believe that any priesthood holder that wanted to could read my thoughts. That was just a normal consequence of the kind of upbringing that I had, which was that this priesthood, this Mormon church thing, this one true church was in some way, it was just as powerful as the devil's ability to bring evil into the home. Like, to me, they were the same thing.
Right. Well, it seems like a natural conclusion to come to. I mean, I think we were taught that, like, the devil can't read your thoughts, but God can.
Right.
And if the priesthood is the power of God, then it seems like a natural conclusion to come to.
Yeah, and I thought God was really interested in trying to figure out my evil mind.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to punish me for those things. It was like the devil would make me do it and God would punish me for it. And I couldn't escape either one of them because the devil was always there doing his thing and my dad and the church were always there doing their thing.
To like judge it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was never going to escape that. And that's why I was so terrified of God, is because I could never escape him. I could never have my own personal private moment. I was never going to be my own human being, my own person, my own mind, my own thoughts. They were always going to be monitored and judged just at the drop of a hat. Every spontaneous thought that I had, I believed was being constantly judged and evaluated. And I could never get on top of that. I could never control that. I was, it was, once again, I'm fundamentally flawed. There's something so effed up about me that I can't get on top of this. Right. No amount of fasting and praying was fixing this. No amount of journal writing and, you know, ward temple night or, you know, the kids do the baptisms for the dead. I did that. Terrified. I was terrified to do that because I was sure that there was something, some crevice of my mind that I hadn't yet mastered, that I was going to be, you know, penalized in ways I couldn't even possibly imagine, that I had allowed myself to go to the temple and do baptisms for the dead, knowing how evil I really was. But yet I also could not in any way withstand the judgment and punishment of not going to the temple. So right. even if I had decided that I'm going to be a good girl and I'm going to declare myself unworthy, that would have been 1,000 times worse than the punishment I could have given myself, the punishment my parents would have given me mm-hmm. for opting out of something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if ever I had chosen to go to my bishop and say, oh, I'm not morally clean. Mm-hmm. I let a boy feel me up. The punishment I would have received from it being obvious I wasn't taking the sacrament, I would have much rather burned in hell for an eternity than take what I knew would be coming my way at home.
Right, right. So how old were you when you realized I can't do this?
I was waiting for my 18th birthday. Like most kids wait for their 18th birthday because they want to have a big party and they want to go out and have, you know, I'm 18, la, la, la. It was an established fact in our home that we could not, once we reached, you know, age 18, we could stay at home as long as we still continued to live by the family standards, which was be a member of the church, be a faithful member of the church, do everything that we would have been doing up until that point. And if that was not the life we wanted for ourselves, because of course that's the choice, you know, it's either the good life or the bad life, mm-hmm. then we had to leave. We had to move out.
I don't know why I thought of this, but it's almost like you had to have an ecclesiastical endorsement to live in your home.
Pretty much.
Like going to BYU, you know?
What? thinking about it, when you put it like that, yeah, absolutely.
And so we were 16, 17 or?
16, 17. And I was just waiting. I mentioned earlier that, you know, it's not surprising that I was a cutter. It wasn't anything extreme, but I definitely learned that releases a lot of internal pain. And I learned to do it in ways that I wouldn't get caught. But that's kind of what got me by. Age 16, 17, 18, because I was literally hanging on for dear life. Let me get to age 18. I cannot exist in this house. I cannot exist as a human being in this environment. If I can just get out of the church, if I can just get out of this house, if I can just walk away, if I can just turn my back and never look over my shoulder, I might have a chance.
And did you think that you would be living in, were you scared of what you'd have to deal with? Like, was the outside world scary to you?
The outside world wasn't scary to me. No, it wasn't scary to me because I honestly believe it really was my only chance of surviving. Had I stayed in my house, I probably would have been found hanging in my closet at some point. There was no way I was going to exist. There was no way I couldn't have made it to age 19. There's no way. I would have really benefited from being able to graduate from high school and then go to college immediately after. But I had to make a choice. Do I want a college education or do I want to live? And for me, it was really clear that I couldn't live. I couldn't live. It was just that simple. And 2 weeks after I turned 18, I moved out. And it was just...
And did you notify your parents, I'm moving out and I'm not going to be Mormon?
I think at that point it was kind of understood that that was the reason why.
And was there like a...
Because there would be no other reason for me to leave my house except for...
Right.
Because I couldn't hack it, basically, so to speak.
Was there like an extra push to try to... turn you before you hit 18?
No, I think they had given up. They had given up that I was going to...
You still have to live by these rules, but we know you're a lost cause type.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much. Like, we know you can't do it. We know you don't want to. We know that whatever it is that you're struggling with, you know, you're 18 now. We don't need to have any part of your... adversarial influence. I think in many, many ways, they were very happy to see me go because I was bringing the adversary into their sacred home. I think they were happy to see me go.
Okay.
And given I was not a drinker. I didn't do drugs. I wasn't sleeping around. I wasn't running away. I wasn't sneaking out at night. I wasn't drunk driving. I wasn't hanging out with any, I mean, none of that was happening. It was a spiritual battle that was being waged in my home, with my family. And that was the problem. I wasn't a rebellious kid.
You just didn't toe the Mormon line.
I just didn't have a testimony.
Yeah.
It just didn't happen.
So what happened when you moved out? What did you start doing with your life?
Well, believe it or not, I moved from California to Salt Lake City. I moved to Salt Lake City to leave the church because my biological father and my stepmom live here in Salt Lake, just a few blocks from us right now. Hmm. And I hate to use this analogy because I don't believe it really is the same thing, but I've used it before in the podcast, and that is the church for me was like an abusive relationship. And when you are in abusive relationships, whether it's a spousal relationship or a child abuse relationship, type of situation with parents, you learn to compartmentalize things. And it was easy for me because I was very skilled at putting things in their proper place so that I could negotiate my day-to-day life. So when I left the church, when I moved out here to Utah, it didn't matter that literally, what are we, 6 blocks from the temple right now?
Yeah.
I was able to just put that into a box and just close the door and never look at it again. I was scared to look at it because I still believe that the church was probably true. There was just something wrong with me. So I'm not going to look at that part of me anymore, because I'm a lost cause on that front. I'm just going to try and make the best of my life with this apparent demonic mm-hmm. flaw mm-hmm. and try and be the best person that I can be in spite of that. And living with my biological father, who still has had a weird sense of Mormonism, My biological father was really disappointed when the Salamander letter turned out to be a false and a forged document mm-hmm. because that's the kind of church he wants to believe in. Mm-hmm. So even though he considered himself Mormon still, even though he'd been excommunicated, he still believed in the church. He just believed in a really different version of it. So it wasn't a threatening version. It was a magical, fantastical virgin. And so it wasn't the same experience. So it was easy for me to just turn my back on that.
And they didn't make you go to church or?
No, I was, for the first time in my life, I was free to listen to the radio if I wanted to. I was free to read any book that I wanted to, investigate other sources of spiritual belief. I could go to the Cathedral of the Madeleine if I wanted to. I could do anything I wanted to do. And I was 18 years old, and I was working at a Holiday Inn call center. You know, it was the first time I'd ever had a job. And I was just trying to do my thing and, you know, definitely making some really bad choices when I look back as far as, like, the whole living on your own thing. Like, I had no skill on how to, like, take care of myself or how to have a personal boundary of any sort. I mean, I didn't have personal boundaries growing up. My boundaries belonged to my dad. Mm-hmm. They belonged to the church. The church told me what was right and wrong. The church told me what I was supposed to do with my body. I already, you know, fundamentally rejected those notions on a cellular level. So
you had to learn by trial and error.
I learned by trial and error, and there was a lot of error. Mm-hmm. A lot of really stupid things, a lot of unsafe things. But I felt like in spite of all those things, I could still be a good person. I really wanted to be a good person. I went to the Utah AIDS Foundation training. I did a training to be a volunteer for that. Like, I really felt like I wanted to be a good person in spite of everything that I had rejected that was supposed to be good and perfect and true and wonderful. And I wanted to show my parents that I could still be a good person, even though I'm sure they don't necessarily value the gay community or whether or not I was trained to be a volunteer for the AIDS Foundation. For me, that was something important.
And I wanted him to see that things that were important to me were good to some people, to somebody. They valued, they had a value and a worth to somebody. I was going to matter to something. You know, right. It wasn't going to be the church, but I was still going to matter somewhere.
Okay. So, you got married at some point in there, had a kid.
I did. I married when I was just barely 20. I still did the whole get married young and have kids thing. I still kind of figured that that was what I was going to do. And he was from a Mormon family, but, and had active mother and stepfather, but he had stopped attending. And that was an emotion, that was an emotionally devoid relationship. I had kind of grown up being fed the line that men that want you sexually don't love you. So I chose a man that didn't want me sexually. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a coincidence that we only have one daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm, you know, maybe he had his own Mormon baggage from that, from his experience in the church, but from an emotional standpoint, from an intimacy standpoint, it was a marriage that was completely devoid of any kind of true intimacy, or romance or affection or anything like that. And I figured that that was normal because he obviously loved me because he didn't want to have sex with me. So this is okay.
Right, right.
That we were married for almost 10 years, which by anybody's standards is a long time.
Yeah. In that time, was there any dabbling with the church? Did you ever, like when you had your daughter, did you think?
There was pressure from his mother to have her blessed. And I was violently opposed to it. When I was about 25 years old, I'd been out of the church for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still too terrified to even look at anything that was considered anti-Mormon literature. Because we've all been taught that they're lies anyway.
Right.
So why would I want to waste my time with what is, you know, obviously a lie? And then also it played into, I didn't want to accentuate my demonality by reading anti-Mormon literature. So I just stayed away from it. But a friend of mine let me borrow Mormon Enigma.
That was written by two faithful women.
Exactly. And, you know, it could easily even be said, well, it was about Emma Hale Smith. It wasn't even about a prophet or, you know, the church per se. So it wasn't even all that bad. That even if it was an iffy source, it wasn't about the Lord's anointed.
Right.
It was just about some woman. Right. And that like blew the lid off some of my, like the early Mormon history. No clue. None. No clue. What? I was just absolutely flabbergasted by some of it. And it was kind of like, ooh, okay, well, I looked at that for a second. I'm just going to put that down and not look at that again, because that is a danger zone of factual knowledge. And I should not have seen that, because now I felt like I had a little bit of a like, okay, well, that's why that didn't make sense to me. Or maybe this is why that didn't feel so right to me. Or maybe there aren't divine origins for this. Maybe this is just kind of just like Scientology. It's just some man-made religion. It's no different than anything else. Like, whoa, that's kind of crazy. I should wait a bit and not look at that again for a minute, because that could be a big deal. And I didn't. For many years. And then the interwebs got plugged in to my house. And just, you know, Google, it'll get you. And I came across Sandra Tanner's website and instantly Adam God, instantly Blood Atonement, instantly the Hoffman, instantly Blacks in the Priesthood, instantly the Book of Abraham, just all of this stuff. And it was just like someone flipped a switch. It was just like,
oh my God, how could I have been, how could my parents believe this? How could they have raised me with this? Both my parents are smart people. My dad has a master's in criminology. He detects facts for a living. He interrogates bad guys to get to the bottom of it. And this was what they had decided was true. Like, they believed it. Like, what? And that's when I started to really think, which I'll go ahead and say it because this isn't more of an expression, cult. Like, this is cult thinking. Not culty, not cultish. This is cult thinking. This is mind control. What I experienced was way beyond what a normal religion. Like, I'm thinking, I don't think the Methodists are dealing with this kind of stuff. Right. I don't think people that want to leave the Lutheran church have to deal with this kind of thing.
Right, right.
You know, like, this is something way different. And there was a sense of kind of like relief, like, okay, maybe I'm not as demonic and flawed as I thought I was. Maybe the problem really was the church. Maybe it wasn't me after all. And I spent several years looking into that off and on because it's like touching a nerve. I mean, you want to look at it. You want to pick at the scab. You want to pick at it. You want it to heal, but you keep picking at it. And so mm-hmm. I would pick at the scab a little bit, and I'd look around, and I'd learn, and I'd read, and then it would get a little too painful, and then I'd put it away. And then that scab would almost be healed, and I'd start digging at it again. And it was probably about 3 years of looking at things off and on before I finally came to a place where I believe that, yes, indeed, there's something fundamentally flawed and false and deceptive about the church. I was still trying to hang on to little bits and pieces that I thought could be good. Oh, well, it's a good, you know, people do this and it's good. Or my parents are good people, so obviously there's parts of it that are good. And I'll just, you know, they find value in it, and it makes them happy, and it makes them good people. So, what's the big deal? And then Prop 8 happened. And I don't watch a lot of local news. And so at the time I was working for Planned Parenthood, and it's a politically active organization, obviously, and they were involved in, we've always been involved in the local gay pride parades and, you know, HIV awareness and condom. You know, I was working for the great Satan at this point. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to hear rumblings about this Prop 8 thing and the Mormon Church. And I, because I was really trying to hang on to that, well, there's good, and they would know, you know, I thought, oh, there's no way the Mormon Church is involved in this. How could they possibly get involved? Churches don't get involved in politics.
Right.
The Mormon Church has good people in it. Good right. people don't infringe upon others' civil rights. They certainly don't do it in other states. Why would they do that? Someone's obviously got lying. It wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And I took my mom to the opera that year for her birthday. Here I am, the demon child, taking my mother to the opera. And I remember saying something like, Mom, is it really true that the church is involved in Prop 8 in California, and that churches like wards and stuff are organizing phone banks and calling people? And like, and she just kind of looked at me like, why would you even bring this up over this, you know, wonderful night together?
Mm-hmm.
You're just at it again. And that she basically just kind of put it under the rug and just said, you know, we feel very strongly the proclamation of the family is you know, the cornerstone of our faith, and it's how families need to structure themselves in order for just blah blah blah, whatever. What can you really say? I mean, she just regurgitated that
the
stuff.
Mormon line, right?
And I knew that it was true, and I knew that the church was actually involved in this. And that was, for me, like, done. I can't do this. From my moral perspective, my moral compass, I couldn't, I could no longer give them an out. I couldn't make excuses for the church anymore that they would be doing this to people that they weren't even members. Really? Come on, Mormon church.
Right. They're expecting.
Work on your own people. Yeah. Ruin your own people's lives. Yeah. You do that well. Keep that up. Stop. You know, you should not even be trying to do this. And I just lost so much respect for anything that I was trying to hold on to that was to give them that benefit of the doubt. That was gone. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just, well, there you go, Mormon church. You screwed that up. You know, I can't even look at you in the face anymore, Mormon church, because you guys suck.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about resigning because Mormons are always showing up on my door. If it's not the Jehovah's Witnesses, it's the Mormons. And I'd much rather entertain the Jehovah's because they at least have a new perspective that I'm not familiar with, you know?
Right, yeah.
And they're not as pushy. Mormons are really pushy.
Especially if you are a Mormon.
Oh, yeah. A couple weeks ago, I was right in the middle of finals, and a couple came from the singles ward because I'm listed as a single. And I said something to them. They were trying to get me to go to church and trying to give me the schedule. And I said, you know, the church and I are diametrically on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to most of the things that the church stands for publicly. And I cannot support these things and so on and so forth. And I had joked with him that I was engaged in my secular feminist intellectual education, and he didn't want to entertain any conversations with an apostate. And he's like, oh, apostate? You're an apostate? Go ahead. Hit me with your best shot. And he was like egging me on. And I was just like, dude, really? You come to my door? I tell you I'm in the middle of writing a paper for finals, and you want to throw your spiritual weight around? Like, you don't get it. I'm not interested. And I'm trying to be polite. And I'm trying to throw this off with a joke and a nod and a wink and try and let you off the hook. But you're kind of being a douche right now. And yeah. You don't even know it.
Yeah.
So I was starting to look into resigning. And I came across postmormon.org and started asking questions about resigning and how the process goes, and will my family find out? Because at that point, I didn't want to hurt my family. I don't want to hurt my family. But, you know, in the last year or so, I became a fan of Mormon Expression. And I definitely have lost the Achilles heel of trying to be polite and nice and palatable to members and their sensibilities. You know, they're always so quick to throw that we who have left the church are offended by something. They are the kings and queens of being offended because I've stayed on the church's records simply to not upset my family.
Right.
Because I don't want to upset them.
That's why I'm on the records.
So, you know, now that we're kind of moving towards the Mormon Expression group, some of us are moving towards maybe a mass resignation. I started to really look at that. And, you know, something John said maybe a month ago or something about, you know, if you were a member of the KKK, would you stay in the KKK, try to change it? Would you try and be the example of tolerance and try and maybe change it from the inside? You know, that's an organization that's never going to change. And my affiliation with an organization like the church is not going to change the church. It's only going to reflect badly on me. It's only going to weigh me down. I'm not going to change the church. They're only benefiting from my membership as a number. And I'm not benefiting at all. And so I'm at the point now where I need to resign. There's no reason for me to stay a part of an organization that I just feel this so, it's like spiritual war crimes against its members and against the community and people that don't even have a dog in the fight. They're out to change the way that they live their lives. And that is not okay. That's that's not okay. That's not how I want to live my life. I don't feel it's right for me to be, connected with this organization anymore. It feels morally...
feels morally wrong to be a member.
It feels morally incorrect. It's not okay.
Gotcha.
I'm still worried what my parents are going to say.
If they ever find out.
I'm sure they will. Who else do you think is sending the board members to my door? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think now, you know, when I went through my divorce, I think my parents, my mother, finally saw me as a human being, because I think she finally related to me as a woman having been through a divorce herself. I think it's the first time she ever saw me as someone that deserved respect and empowerment. And so we have a good relationship now, both my parents and I. And I think that they would understand why I would want to resign. And I think that they do believe that I am a moral person. I'm quite sure they don't agree with my morals, but they see that I want to be connected to things that I deeply believe in. And I want to be connected to those things for the right reasons. And it's amazing to me that I grew up believing I could never be someone that was deeply moral outside of the church. And the greatest compliments that my mother can ever give me are things that when she says how well I'm raising my daughter, mm-hmm. or the loyalty, the service organizations that I align myself with, and the work that I want to do, the work that I have done with Planned Parenthood and the education and community type things, those are things that I deeply believe in. And she knows that they are forming how, and I'm sure she's confused by it too. Somehow they're allowing me to still be a good person and raise a good daughter. And I'm not out shooting heroin. And I'm not, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't even have alcohol in my home.
You're not in prison.
I'm not in prison. Although I would protest and be arrested in a heartbeat. I am not afraid of jail. but those are the kind of things that I didn't believe I'd be capable of without the church. Not that the church wants to be protesting, but. You know, that I could have a moral compass.
Right.
That I could feel deeply passionate about things that are good and what I believe are honorable.
Right. Well, then I guess we're at the end. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
And thank you for all the work you do on Mormon Expression.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good people. Good people.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. You can't beat it with a stick. Some of the best people I've ever met.
I agree.
You included, Heather Clarkson.
Oh, thank you.
Sister Clarkson.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks. Bye.
This episode of Mormon Expression Voices was directed, produced, and edited by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today. As I make no excuse.